Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Let's get cracking this hour with eggs. And who knew we were in the middle of a crisis about eggs? Turns out the egg timer is running out on a ballot initiative passed in 2016 here in the Commonwealth. As of 1st of January, it says you can no longer sell eggs here from hens that have less than 1.5 square feet of floor in their cages. Do you remember voting yes on that? Well, the rest of the country uses a different standard, and 90% of our eggs come from the rest of the country, according to the New England Brown Egg Council. So unless the legislature makes a change, we are in for a scramble. Now, we will take your calls on this. If egg prices skyrocket, will it hit your personal bottom line? Are eggs a staple in your household? And what will you do if supply suddenly drops off a cliff? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. Joining us first, Bill Bell, General Manager of the New England Brown Egg Council. Bill, welcome.
Thank you. And thank you, Tiziana, for that very concise but comprehensive introduction to the subject.
Thanks. I appreciate that. So let's talk about that. Massachusetts was cutting edge when we passed this referendum back in 2016. But since then, the industry has gone in a different route than this 1.5 square feet, right?
That's correct. And it's not because the industry wanted to be difficult. It's because in 2017, after the referendum was passed, the egg industry nationally and the Humane Society of the United States spent the best part of 2017 both with scientific advisory councils saying, okay, the handwriting's on the wall, the legal deadlines have been set. Now, how do we precisely ensure both the best production-wise housing for the hens and the best hens for hens in terms of hen welfare? And that's when we arrived at a slightly different standard, which all the other states, plus the entire private sector, the McDonald's and the Dunkin' Donuts and the restaurant chains all over the country have adopted. And we had hoped by this time that Massachusetts would make what is a pretty modest catch-up amendment.
And that is basically, Bill, as I understand it, it's a foot instead of 1.5, but there's more vertical space and there's this vertical stacking system. Is that correct?
That's correct, because the hen welfare people noted, you know, birds like to fly up and they like to roost in trees. And it also added what they call hen enhancements, which are scratching areas for hens, little perches for hens, and nesting areas for hens, none of which was in the original Massachusetts language.
So I have to tell you, I find that adorable, the concept of hen enhancements. I love animals. That's a lovely thought. I know that this is a serious business, though. And so I want to ask you, if the rest of the industry made a move towards the direction Massachusetts was trying to push for, and we are out of sync of it, how do we find ourselves in a situation, Bill, where in 2 weeks we could, pun absolutely intended, be scrambling to get enough eggs here in the state?
I guess I have to say the wheels of government grind exceedingly slowly as well as exceedingly fine. And we thought we had this amendment back in 2019. And then at the last moment, there were some objections from a legislator, which have since been dealt with. And then we had COVID, and your good legislators were distracted, to put it mildly. We all were distracted. And but back in June, the Massachusetts State Senate passed the necessary amendment. And then early this fall, the House of Representatives did. And it's unfortunate that there's this minor difference between the two that has yet to be resolved.
So Governor Baker's pressuring the state legislature to amend it in time for January 1st. What are you hearing? Is the legislature responding? And I understand that given they're out of formal session, which means that anything that happens now has to be by unanimous vote. One person can scuttle things. So what are you hearing?
It all rests now with the Committee of Conference, which is, of course, traditional when there's different versions in the two bodies. And those six individuals, and all of them, have met with members of our industry, including myself, and have said, yes, we want to get this resolved. And the difference, ironically, has absolutely nothing to do with eggs. It has to do with a provision that the House added concerning the time limit or the time deadline for pork products.
So you've got this other issue in the mix. I want to ask you a couple of more questions here. State Senator Becca Rausch told State House News Service, quote, "I don't want Massachusetts families to have to pay upward of $5 per dozen of eggs come January 1st, end quote. $5 is a lot. Realistically, is that what we're looking at? Could we get to the point? Is that hyperbole? And how short could we be? What percentage of eggs that are on our shelves now realistically might not be there, let's say, come January 7th?
It all depends on how quickly the legislature can move in these 2.5 weeks that are left. Because if they fix this on December 30th, you can't just have a huge farmer's market on the Boston Common and everybody drives in and picks up their eggs there. It goes through supermarkets throughout the states and and the cartons have to be correct. The pricing has to be correct in the computers. There's a supply chain issue, which is not hugely difficult, but it takes more than a week to get that established correctly.
So, Bill, last question for you. I mean, the Massachusetts voters voted on this. They wanted 1.5 square feet of floor space. Is it your assertion that if the Commonwealth makes this change and comes into line with where the industry standard is now, that we will be in keeping with the will of the people?
Absolutely. And I can say this, if you were to go back and look at the material that was distributed by the Secretary of State's office to advise voters, and they have like these one-page crib sheets on all the ballot questions, and there was no mention of 1.5 versus 1.0. It was referenced to the hens being able to move about comfortably. And so, yes, in the details of the law, it did say 1.5. But inasmuch as everybody involved, particularly the humane organizations, agree that the 1.0, along with the vertical space that's being provided, is an improvement, then I think Massachusetts voters can be absolutely satisfied that the law, terms of the law as intended when they voted, have been met.
All right. That is Bill Bell, General Manager at the New England Brown Egg Council. Bill, thanks for the time.
You're welcome.
So joining us now for this conversation, John Pregantis, the owner and chef at Party Favors, which is a bakery and party supply store in Brookline. Welcome, John.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
John, how many eggs do you use in a week for your business?
We use a lot of eggs. We go through 8 cases, which is like 30 dozen in a case. So do the math, and it's like 240 dozen maybe on average.
I appreciate you doing that math. And how much does that cost you right now?
Well, that's right now we're paying, the last invoice was $1.92 a dozen. And then if you go back a few invoices back in October, we're paying $1.10 a dozen.
So prices had already started to increase.
They're starting to go up like 50, 60% already.
And how worried are you about this situation with the law changing on January 1st?
Well, it's going to affect the cost, of course. So then what do we do then? I hate to raise prices, but how do you avoid it, you know? If the eggs are going up, and we use a lot of eggs and everything, just the cakes and the mousse and everything, then you have to pass it on, which I hate to do, but we have no choice.
Do you feel like that could really hit your bottom line? Could you have the margins where you can afford to pass on costs like that?
We don't have that kind of margin, no. Especially nowadays with lack of supply chain and not having employees, not having to find product. I mean, it's hard to get at things, and it's just, it's a tough time right now for everybody.
Are you a part of any business association or group of people trying to get the legislature to make this change before January 1st?
Say it again. I'm sorry, couldn't you?
I'm sorry. Are you trying to reach the legislature? Are there business associations representing your industry that are trying to get the legislature to make this change?
I'm going to look into that because this is I didn't realize it was happening in January. I probably actually voted for it in, 2016. I'm one of those people probably that voted for it and without realizing the impact it would do because it's great for the animals, but the bottom line is like, then what did we do, So it's like, I think we have to do something as a business community to talk to the legislature and do something.
And I do want to note, we reached out to a wide, too many to list, range of parties in an attempt to put this segment together today, and most did not want to go on record and have the conversation. So how do your customers support you right now, and what is your message to your customers if we face a possibility here, John, that your prices are going to have to go up or that you literally won't have the eggs you need to produce your products?
It's going to, our customer base is they're a wonderful community. We've been here for 30 years, so we've done people's wedding cakes 30 years ago, done their bar mitzvah cakes 15 years ago, and now we're doing their daughters, their wedding cakes for their kids. So we have a long, very good following with our customers, and if we have to pass it on, there's nothing we can do about it,
Yep.
And we've tried not to increase as much as possible through the whole, through the years here, too. And during COVID and everything, it's just been really tough.
All right, that is John Pregantis, the owner and chef at Party Favors, a bakery and party supply store in Brookline. John, good luck. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
It's happening again. Cornell, Princeton, Middlebury College, part of a growing number of universities moving finals online and sending students home after COVID outbreaks on campus. We are heading into a holiday break, and it's unclear what will happen in the new year, especially with the new extremely transmissible Omicron variant taking hold. We know something now, though, that we didn't the first time colleges went remote, that the mental health trade-offs are there, the mental health trade-offs that come with keeping students' bodies safe from COVID. And that is compounded by shortages of services, workers, and healthcare coverage across the field of mental health. So should colleges and universities think about the trade-off between COVID health and mental health differently this time around? Let's talk about it. And if you are a college student or you're the parent of a college student, we'd like to hear from you. What do you want to see your college campus do? How hard is the prospect of remote school again? And do you have access to the supports you need? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK or tweet us. We're at Radio Boston. We will go to the phone soon, but first, we want to get a student perspective here. Fareen Khan is a senior and the outgoing speaker of the Student Senate at UMass Boston. Fareen, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Fareen, I know that you're graduating in just a few weeks. You're a senior. Congratulations for that. I want to ask you, are you worried right now? Are you worried for your classmates about what you're seeing with some local universities and this rise of Omicron?
Well, absolutely. I think that the worry stems from the fact that we're, again, I almost feel deja vu because it feels like March 2020 again. We're surrounded by uncertainty, by burnout, by just like not really knowing what's going to happen with our classes, with our universities. And like, I'm lucky in the sense that worry like doesn't really exist for me because I'm graduating. But if I were like in those shoes, I'm absolutely like, the uncertainty surrounding colleges right now, and then like we're going to go back online, if we're going to stay in person, it's just, I guess here on this round we're more prepared because we know what to expect if we do go online, but it's just that uncertainty, not knowing what's going to happen. And
Fareen, talk about that where, how does it sit on you, that wear and tear of just not knowing what might happen?
It's very heavy. It's very heavy, and I don't think people truly understand it unless they're a student themselves, because we're in a world that is still dealing with a pandemic, and a lot of us have changed because of that. We've changed as students. We've changed as people. There's a pressure upon us because, it's just we don't know what's going to happen. We don't know what to expect. And on top of that, we have finals, we have classes, we have assignments, we have all of these issues that are compounding on us, but it's 10 times the normal college experience. College is already very stressful, and then add on to it a global pandemic with so much uncertainty, with not knowing what's going to happen, with not knowing what's going to happen with our classes, our friendships, stuff like that. We don't really know where we're going to stand.
Fareen, how are you doing, and how have you been doing?
Honestly, I have not been doing very well. I'm going to be very honest because I think it's very important for us to acknowledge the pandemic and the impact it has had on students themselves. I have changed a lot during the pandemic. My mental health has gotten really, really bad because the pandemic has exacerbated our mental health, And when we came back in person, we weren't really given the chance to recalibrate, or we weren't really given the chance to adjust to from being inside for a year and a half and then suddenly acting like everything is normal and back again. And it was very, very hard to adjust to that. And, it had a toll on our mental health. And I'm graduating, and I'm very lucky I'm graduating, because I'm not entirely sure if I could handle another semester of uncertainty and not knowing where I stand.
I'm sorry, it's been a struggle, and I'm sorry to interrupt you there. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. A lot of what I have felt and a lot of what my fellow peers have said is that we haven't really recovered from COVID-19 and we haven't recovered from feeling not like ourselves. It's almost like a brain fog. We have burnout. We have just a pandemic-induced reality that we still are suffering with. And to add to that another layer of uncertainty and confusion, it's just a lot of wear and tear, and it's just a lot of toll on our mental health.
Do you have the supports that you need from your university community?
So one thing I will commend my university for, University of Massachusetts Boston, is that when we did transition online in March 2020, the university put a very comprehensive list of frequently asked questions that were constantly updated because there was a lot of unanswered questions. And so they did that, and that helped to assuage any fears that we had. But of course, not anyone can predict what's going to happen and stuff like that. So I do want to appreciate, I do appreciate that the university did that. And I also want to make note of the UHS counseling center that have offered services. And I've heard that they're very good. But I will note that I do feel like they're very overwhelmed and understaffed, because when I did try to make an appointment, they said they were available mid-January. Of course, I'm graduating in 2 weeks, so I wouldn't be able to take that appointment. So I will note that I feel like it's not just my university, but a lot of universities have had an influx of students trying to get services, but it's just overwhelming the entire mental health services, and I think that they're understaffed.
So I appreciate you telling us your story. Before we let you go, what's next for you? Is there something you're looking forward to or excited about in the coming weeks?
Yeah, so I am looking forward to starting my master's in January. My master's is going to be completely online. The graduate program has moved completely online because of COVID. So I am kind of worried, though, because an online education takes away a lot of the in-person interactions and joys and the social element and the friendship element. It becomes very different. So I am worried that my brain fog will continue. Confusion, memory loss, and my inability to concentrate. I'm worried that's going to continue, but I am looking forward to starting that. And, I will be going from online to in-person this semester and then online again. So I already am facing online school, but I'm kind of more optimistic about it because I know what to expect. And, it's going to be a new chapter for me. So I'm looking forward to that.
That is Fareen Khan. She's a graduating senior and the outgoing speaker of the Student Senate at UMass Boston. Good luck on that new chapter, Fareen. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And listeners, just a note, if you feel like you need help, you can reach these resources. The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800 273-TALK. That's 273-8255. And the Samaritan statewide hotline is 1-877-870-HOPE. That's 877-870-4673, and you can call or text that number. I do want to bring in a couple of other guests, but I'm going to grab a call real quick. 1-800-423-8255. Suzanne's calling from Sharpsburg, Georgia. Suzanne, hello.
Hi, go ahead. How are you?
Well, thanks, Suzanne. Go ahead. Tell us your story.
Okay, so my son is a junior now at San Francisco State University in the film program, and COVID hit in his second semester of his freshman year. So the entirety of his college experience, for the most part, has been online learning. And I saw my son go from being enthusiastic and willing to learn and excited about learning with in-person classes to the online class where he felt isolated and alone. Because learning as a young adult is a collaborative experience. They get so much out of being in person. And he begged me to take a gap year, and I encouraged him to keep going. And now that they're back in-person learning, his grades have not only improved, but his mental health has improved as well, too. So as a parent, you know, seeing both sides of these things, I feel for the university, and I feel for the teachers, but I also feel for the students.
Suzanne, thanks. I appreciate that call, and I wish your son well. So joining us now, two people from the mental health field and focusing on colleges, Dr. Carrie Landa, Director of Behavioral Medicine and the Associate Director of Student Health Services at Boston University. She's stepping out of those roles and into a new role as the school's first Executive Director of Student Well-Being. She also serves on the college's university COVID task force. Dr. Landa, welcome.
Thank you.
And Dr. Caitlin Nevins, the Director of Psychological Services in the College Mental Health Program at McLean Hospital. Dr. Nevins, welcome to you, too.
Thank you for having me.
So, Dr. Landa, I'm just going to ask you for your reactions either to Fareen's story there or what we just heard from our caller, Suzanne.
Both of their stories are really familiar, and it's what we've been hearing throughout the pandemic, really since a month or so after we went into lockdown, when we all realized the long haul that we were in for. The anticipatory anxiety and that kind of not knowing that Fareen was alluding to about what the next semester is going to bring is something very real for all of our students. It's real for all of us as humans or who are navigating this as well. But that unknown about what is going to happen and what trajectory COVID is going to continue to take, it's really hard. It's a hard space to be sitting in, especially when it has impacts on learning and socialization and the ways in which many of these college students had thought that their college years were going to go.
You know, I do want to note, especially since we're talking about BU campus life, in part here that Boston University holds the license for WBUR, and I think I should also note I actually have a sophomore at Boston University, so this is a subject that's close to my heart, too. Dr. Nevins, I'll turn to you for a second. College Mental Health Program at McLean Hospital, have you pivoted in your focus since COVID, or has it been more of an intensification of issues you were focused on before? Do you understand my question?
Sure. And I would say the answer is no, we haven't. And yes, we have. At the same time, I think everybody has had to pivot, right? It's doesn't do it justice at this point to say these are unprecedented times because we've been saying that for so long, but we've absolutely had to shift and evolve according to student needs. Our programs are now happening virtually. We're reaching students we couldn't reach before because of geographical location. So our services have really expanded in that way. And yet at the same time, our focus has remained exactly the same, which is really a strengths-based identity-informed approach to supporting student well-being and helping them navigate the challenges and barriers that exist as a college student outside of COVID, but of course now taking into consideration that cumulative effect. And we have to be bringing that into the conversation and not in some ways going on as if business is normal, because we know it isn't for everyone.
You know, we just had a parent caller a minute ago. We've got a student caller, too. I'd like to get that voice here. 1-800-423-8255. Carter is on the line in Newton. Carter, go ahead.
Hey, thank you so much. So I recently graduated from college this past summer. I graduated from the University of Michigan. And I just wanted to say, so you started off the program by saying that some colleges had decided to move their exams online. And when I hear that, I fear, you know, that like next semester there'll be a return to remote learning at other schools, just because, you know, the way that these things spread, and especially Omicron being more transmissible, it's that sort of, if they're already moving finals online, it's likely that there's going to be some more remote learning. And I just wanted to say that, you know, from the perspective of somebody who did the last half of his college education during, you know, online during COVID, I really think this is just like a misguided measure that just goes way too far and just has its priorities totally out of whack. I mean, at this point, we have three great vaccines. We have boosters. They're free. We have Pfizer came out with the COVID pill that, you know, cuts hospitalization significantly. And for young people, the risks have always been, or I don't want to say they're, you know, they aren't there, because they are, and they're especially, you know, for immunocompromised people. But
lower.
The risks are just so low. And I just think, like, the trade-offs of moving school online are just so huge. And it's a shell of what college is. And I just,
thanks, Carter.
I really think the college is, need to take another approach.
Thanks, Carter. So, Dr. Landa, you know, you are now Executive Director of Student Wellbeing. We've heard two voices now, Farine with that longer conversation, Carter there clearly feeling strongly. He's just graduated a few months ago from university. How do you think about the trade-offs? I mean, we are talking about body risk, spirit risk, and mental health risk.
It's a really important point, and I think, you know, the student who just called in, or the recent graduate, and Farin, as well as the caller from Georgia whose son experienced this, the toll that online learning has taken on students is incredible. You know, at BU, we have had taken really extreme measures to keep our campus safe with testing and masking that some have questioned, why are we doing so much? But in order to have our residential experience, which we feel is imperative for the university experience, for students learning, for development, for socialization, for all of the things that Farin and the other callers have alluded to, we feel that doing what we're doing to protect our campus from COVID is worth it, so that they can have that in-person experience, because there's nothing that replaces that. Being on Zoom, being, you know, whether learning on Zoom or socializing on Zoom, does not take the place of normal organic interactions that happen on a college campus that really contribute to development of college students.
Dr. Nevins, what do young people in this age group need for their mental health well-being? What do they need from this experience? And what should family members be looking for right now?
Well, the list is certainly extensive. It's what they need, but it's also what they deserve. And I think that first and foremost is so often just the validation of the difficulty of this experience. And we hear so many students that have maintained their expectations of, I need to do X, Y, and Z and maintain a job and get perfect grades and balance this crisis. And they haven't been flexible with themselves or had that self-compassion to say, okay, this is really hard. So if families can do that, and if providers can do that, and if colleges and universities can do that and really reflect back, we can't probably operate in the same way. And increased compassion and flexibility, policy changes, understanding the need for medical leave of absences, all of that. So providing that support and really making sure that we can mirror that back to students, that this is so, it's so valid to be struggling at this time. And the challenges are real, whether you're in person and dealing with those stressors or remote. So I think that support and validation. But of course, you know, the social interaction, extensions on tests, and understanding that they're safe in their environment, and acknowledgement of different sociocultural student identities, all of that, it's really an interconnected web of student needs in order for them to really thrive and feel safe in their college experience.
So, Dr. Landa, there is this dissonance. So much of young people's lives is already spent online. Many college and university programs, as we heard about Farine's, already her master's degree program is fully online. I mean, you can get a college degree entirely online. Why is it problematic, if it keeps people's physical health safe, to be remote? Why is it problematic? And with young people so online anyway?
I think the fact that they're so online is really what's an important part of this. We want to counter that with in-person normal experiences that, you know, living a life online is only part of what human interaction is. It's edited. It's not spontaneous as you know, talking with a friend in real person, in real life can be. The way we engage, the way we express ourselves is different with body language even that you can't see when you know, your head is just on a Zoom screen, for example, or even on social media. So the experiences that students have in their residences, for example, or in graduate programs when they're all in rooms together working collectively on a project, there's value in just the interpersonal experience. It's not even the content of what they're learning, but how we navigate relationships, how we navigate communication, all these things that you can be the best scientist, but if you don't have those skills that are so core to human interaction, you might not be as successful. So that's what we value so much about this in-person component of a residential campus or the learning experience.
And Dr. Nevins, the changes that you're talking about, you know, are changes in attitudes and pressure and potentially giving leave, those kinds of things, these are big changes. Are you optimistic that our big systems and institutions can and will and are making those kinds of changes?
I am optimistic. It would be a really hard job if I wasn't, but I really am. I mean, part of the work we do in the College Mental Health Program is consulting and collaborating with colleges and universities, and they are asking these questions and revisiting policies and wanting to find out ways to better support student well-being, both reactively through the provision of services, but also proactively. How can they foster a healthy culture that really encourages student well-being. So I am optimistic, and schools have different resources, different circumstances, but I don't think we can go back to the way things were. And I don't think anyone's looking to. I think everyone really is recognizing the need to shift the balance in sort of quality of life and well-being, the student experience. So I'm really looking forward to seeing schools do that throughout the next few years.
And Dr. Landa, it really just in a couple of sentences, what's the biggest shift you hope to be responsible for in your new role?
You know, I think so much focus has been put on mental health over the past several years, which is incredible. We've reduced stigma and really increased students' willingness to access support that they need. But we really want students to think broadly about the different ways that they can support their well-being. Mental health is an incredible part of it, but community is also incredibly valuable. Physical health is important, just as much as the environment that they live in. So really having students think broadly, again, about those different dimensions that contribute to their well-being, not just as students, but once they leave the university.
All right. That's Dr. Carrie Landa, who is stepping into a new role as Boston University's first Executive Director of Student Well-Being. Thank you. And Dr. Caitlin Nevins, Director of Psychological Services in the College Mental Health Program at McLean Hospital. Thanks to you as well. It is a Christmas classic, the story of a miserly, horrible human being who is given a chance at redemption on Christmas night.
You will be haunted by three spirits. Without their visits, you cannot hope to shun the path I tread. Expect the first tomorrow, when the bell tolls one.
On Point host Meghna Chakrabarty there, reading from Charles Dickens's A Christmas Carol, which is an annual tradition at WBUR. It is a story told and retold over almost 200 years now. But did you know that thousands of people turned out in 1867 to hear Dickens himself read the story here in Boston? Susan Wilson is the official house historian of the Omni Parker House in Boston. Dickens stayed at the Parker House during his visit, and we asked her to tell us that story. Wilson spoke with us a little earlier today, and we started by asking her, why did Charles Dickens, a British author, come to Boston in 1867 to read A Christmas Carol aloud to grown adults?
The reason that Charles Dickens came to Boston was that he was on a reading tour. He had only been to Boston one other time back in 1842, but in 1867, probably the most popular Christmas book in the world was A Christmas Carol, and he had written it, and he'd written it back in 1843, but he'd never read it aloud in the United States. And people were huge fans of his by that time and were looking forward to it. And so he had scheduled to come here for 5 months straight, starting in the end of November in 1867, extending into April of 1868, and was doing readings not only in Boston, but all over the Northeast. But Boston was his home base, and his home suite was at the Parker House. So the suite that he kept for those 5 months was at the Parker House.
So was reading out loud to audiences a thing at the time, or unique to Charles Dickens?
Reading out loud was a thing, but Charles Dickens was a rock star. Basically, at that time, we're not just talking before the internet or before TV or movies or before radio. This is before all of that. And so reading was a passion for people, and people would go to readings. And for someone like Dickens, who was an extraordinary reader because he was a trained actor as well, it was a performance. And so people would pay all kinds of money, wait in long lines to get tickets. There were scalpers who would sell tickets to his readings. And it was not unusual for 2,000 people to show up for one of his readings.
So I want to back up a little bit, because this context is really interesting. You say the book was the most popular Christmas story in 1867 around the world at that time. So what was going on? Tell us about Boston in 1867. Tell us about Christmas in 1867 in that era.
Okay. Well, in order to answer that well, I have to backtrack just a little bit. Boston was founded, was settled by the Puritans back in 1630. There was no Christmas then, and there was no Christmas basically for a couple of hundred years, because the Puritans thought it was a ridiculous holiday. It was overblown. They didn't like the music. They thought it was a bogus holiday because nobody really knew when Christ was born. It was too associated with the Anglican Church and the Catholic Church, and they were Puritans. They wanted to purify everything. As a matter of fact, it was associated with sometimes with people going out and getting drunk and begging for money in return for singing and stuff like that. And it was actually banned in Boston in 1659.
Christmas banned in Boston.
Christmas was banned in Boston. Okay, it became illegal. The general court made it illegal. It only lasted about a dozen years, but basically there was no taste for it. By about 10 or 15 years before Dickens came in 1867, there was a revival, but it was a different kind of Christmas, much more like our modern day Christmas. So instead of a lot of people being drunk in the streets and wassailing and things like that, there were a lot of different things that were happening. For starters, there were many immigrants coming to Boston who were bringing from, for example, Germany, where the Christmas tree came from, people coming from who were Irish Catholic, etc. And so a lot of this started coming in, and people were starting to espouse it. Also, Dickens came in as part of a literary trend that was building up the idea of Christmas as well. Back in 1819, Washington Irving, he of Headless Horseman fame, had created the image of Santa Claus flying in a sleigh. And it was only a few years later that Clement Moore wrote this poem, A Visit from St. Nicholas, which we know as 'Twas the Night Before Christmas. So this entire thing of a kinder, gentler Christmas, also very children-centered, had been growing, and it was really capped off by A Christmas Carol. A Christmas Carol was actually written back in 1843. And so this was, you know, almost 25 years since it had been written, and Bostonians already loved it. So when he was going to come to read it, it was a big thing.
So why the Parker House, right? Because I want to dive into this history. He didn't just go anywhere. When he read it in Boston, he read it at the Parker House. And as you've said, that was his home base.
Right. The Parker House was the place in Boston. Harvey Parker had started it back in 1855, knowing he was competing with a growing number of hotels that were dealing with the new affluence in America. And so he created a place that had great food. It was on the European plan. You could, you know, get food at any time of day, order what you wanted instead of a stock meal. With gorgeous surroundings, but even more importantly, because so many local people loved it, starting back in 1855, just a few months after it opened, a group of local gentlemen started meeting there, and at the last Saturday of every month, they would meet and have a round table and drink and read to each other. And among those people were Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Thoreau, Hawthorne, Oliver Wendell Holmes, etc., etc. So the guys who were at the center, and I say guys because it was all guys, the guys who were at the center of what was called the Golden Age of American Literature, which really began in Boston, were all there. So it was a very logical place for the biggest superstar in the English-speaking world in literature to come there.
And of course, we should acknowledge that means that it was the circle of power of the time, but that was white, you know, moneyed, landed men who were kind of running the literature scene. And it would have been an exclusive hotel at that time as well. So he comes to the Parker House, I understand, a little bit sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? Under guise, right? He's kind of swept there to avoid the mob when he gets to Boston.
He is. He does. He comes in on the steamer called Cuba. They pick him up in the nighttime and whisk him away to the Parker House, where he's greeted by owner Harvey Parker. And they do have like armed guards around. I mentioned he was like a rock star. This is really true. People loved him so much, but they also wanted to see him and touch him and all this. And so they had guards around his room, his suite. And he would also, he would stand in front of a mirror and practice doing his various antics that he would do in the gestures that he would do as he was doing the characters during his readings. And people wanted to see him do that. And when he walked out in the street, which he loved to do a lot, he was an inveterate walker, they would run up and try not only to get his autograph, but to grab part of his coat, because he often wore this fur coat with the fur on the outside, and they would grab bits of his coat. And so he was a big star, and they had to watch him very carefully. He was also not very well. He suffered from a sickness the whole time he was here. And sadly, 2 years after he left here, he actually died in 1870. Mm-hmm. So he never quite got over the illness that he had.
Let's talk about the mirror he practiced in front of. I'm sure you know the WBUR does an annual reading of the Christmas Carol. In years past, we'd done that at the Omni Parker House. The first time I did it, I actually got to rehearse a few of my lines in front of that mirror, which was kind of a crazy feeling. You still have that mirror on display.
We do indeed. It used to be in Dickens' suite. However, we couldn't, there is a Dickens room, but we didn't want people going into a room that other people might be using or renting. So it's out in the hallway. If you come in and take the elevator to the mezzanine level, you can see it in the hallway. And it's a huge mirror. It's gigantic. And it is a favorite place for people to take selfies.
Understood. Take us to the room of a reading. What am I seeing? How many people are in the room? I know you've said he could attract thousands. What's happening in the room when he reads this story?
Okay, well, for starters, when he was reading in Boston, he was reading right next door at Tremont Temple, because Tremont Temple is a 19th century building that's been rebuilt, I think, four times, but it's always gone back and forth between a church and a theater. To this day, it's still used for theatrical things as well as a church. So there would be lines of people outside, many of big shots, you know, like Longfellow and Emerson, et cetera. All those guys would also be in line. They would come inside. The audiences, now I don't know the exact capacity that night, but easily 1,000 to 2,000 people there. He would come out on stage. He would travel with a maroon backdrop that he would put behind him. There would be a small desk with a place to put his arm. And then he would have a little book that would have a condensed version, because clearly he couldn't read all of it, even though A Christmas Carol is quite short. It's actually a novella, not a novel. But he would have this small book that he actually rarely looked at, because he knew the parts so well. And he'd have a carafe of water. And they'd have lights on him, the gas lights that would be shining in his way because there was no electricity at that time. And everybody would be in a hush, and he would start reading. And his performances were generally 2 hours long, but people would laugh, they would cry. He had them in, you know, the palm of his hand. He was just a wonderful actor. He was also he dressed, you know, like in a kind of a bohemian manner. He always had a hat and a cravat and tall, shiny boots and gloves and a cape. So he just looked like the theater person and did not disappoint anyone.
So I want to talk about the story itself for just a minute. It has had incredible staying power. You've talked about how popular it was at the time. It remains popular. Readers, listeners, viewers over the centuries almost now have stayed in love with it. We put together a little montage of Christmas Carol movie adaptations over the years. Here it is.
You were always a good man of business, Jacob. Business. Mankind should have been my business. Charity, forbearance, benevolence. All were my business, as they should be yours.
And with that, the spirits of Scrooge's partners vanished into the darkness, leaving him once again alone in his room.
Whoa, that's scary stuff. Hey, should we be worried about the kids in the audience?
No, it's all right. This is culture.
I get it now. And if you give... Then it can happen. Then the miracle can happen to you. It's not just the poor and the hungry. It's everybody who's got to have this miracle. And it can happen tonight for all of you.
So that was 1935, the classic Scrooge starring Seymour Hicks. It was the 1992 Muppet Christmas Carol narrated by Gonzo and Rizzo the Rat. And then Bill Murray in the 1988 adaptation Scrooged. Why does this story stay with us this way?
Well, first of all, it's a great story. Okay. I mean, you know, ghosts and all that and revisiting, past, present, future. That's all lovely. But I think the essence and the reason it really fit into and has nurtured the feeling of Christmas is its emphasis on joy, on family, on merriment. And then this final message of redemption that in a single night, Scrooge turns his entire life around. And how can you miss with that?
And what do you love most about the story?
Tiny Tim.
Fair enough. That is Susan Wilson, the official house historian of the Omni Parker House. Susan, what fun. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
Who doesn't love Tiny Tim? Before we go, we wanted to take a minute to tell you about WBUR's live annual reading of A Christmas Carol coming up at City Space this Monday. Amy McDonald is here, the director of City Space. Welcome.
Hello, I'm glad to be here.
So full disclosure, I am one of the people reading on Monday night, very excited about it. Tell our listeners about what the event will look like.
The event is charming. It is Monday at 7 o'clock, and we have five of our hosts reading a chapter each from The Christmas Carol, interwoven with Christmas carols being sung by an a cappella group, and we have an intermission with hot chocolate and cookies. And you'll be surprised at the thespian abilities of our hosts. They really get into it. It is a charming, charming, charming event.
Online and in person this year? Just in person?
It's in person at City Space, and we also have a virtual ticket for sale. If you go to wbur.org/events, you can buy a ticket for Monday night.
And proceeds. Where do they go?
They go to Rosie's Place. This is our 19th year. We have a long relationship with Rosie's Place, supporting this. This is a fundraiser for Rosie's Place, which is beyond a woman's shelter. They provide legal assistance, classes, wellness care. It's a wonderful, wonderful organization.
And last question for you. What's your favorite part about the event every year?
I think it's those children coming and just loving, just seeing their eyes wide open and really getting into the story and then, of course, diving into the hot chocolate.
Yeah, the hot chocolate's always really good. That's WBUR City Space Director Amy McDonald. Amy, thanks. And let's go out with a little bit of last year's reading, which we actually played in its entirety for the first time on air because of the pandemic. Here's a voice I think listeners will all recognize. This is WBUR's Bob Oakes reading his piece, which he will read for the last time next Monday night.
And it was always said of Scrooge, he knew how to keep Christmas well if any man alive possessed that knowledge. And may that be truly said of all of us. And so, as Tiny Tim observed, God bless us, everyone.
That's our show for today, folks. Thanks for listening. Tune in again tomorrow for Radio Boston's Week in Review.